So this is Zahar Zaidi on the chicken and egg reference.
Zahar.
Yes.
Much better.
Yeah. If everyone can just bear with me, my throat's a bit off today. But I'm presenting the case Attorney General of Manitoba versus Manitoba Egg and Poultry Association. This was in 1971. So the main point of this reading was it was introduced the flexibility of the federal government's trade and commerce power along with a narrow interpretation of POG, peace, order, and good government. Previously, the JCPC divided the power over trade and commerce by stating that anything that was between provinces fell under their jurisdiction, and anything that was related to the transaction in provinces fell under the provincial government. So this created problems in marketing and distribution of products across provinces, in addition to exporting Canadian goods abroad. So the case in question was in an economic struggle that took place with Quebec and neighboring provinces. So Quebec was a major importer of eggs, and FEDCO, which is Quebec's egg marketing agency, had restricted egg imports into the province to protect egg producers. Provinces that were affected by this action were Manitoba and Ontario, who were major egg exporters in Quebec. Reversely, Quebec was a major exporter of broilers, therefore the chicken aspect of this case, but it was finding it hard to sell them to other provinces because they were retaliating against the FEDCO's restrictions. Manitoba, which was affected the most by the egg import restrictions, took the situation to court by initiating a reference case in its own Court of Appeals. So the regulations referred in the court resembled the egg marketing scheme in Quebec. The case was supposed to be hypothetical because Manitoba was not an importer of eggs. Despite this, the Manitoba court found the regulations were not limited to the province, and this decision was upheld in the Supreme Court of Canada. The case was supposed to bring to the attention of the judges to what degree was a provincial marketing scheme affected through interprovincial trade without becoming unlawful. The decision was that the Manitoba egg marketing scheme did result in interprovincial trade and therefore fell under the federal legislator under the Trade and Commerce Act, Section 91. Provinces were then prevented from using marketing schemes to protect local producers from out-of-province competition. Down the road, this would be reversed through the workings of cooperative federalism. So the comment I had on this case was that, personally, in my opinion, I did agree with the ruling of the court, the Manitoba court and the Supreme Court of Canada, because it did, because these kind of transactions were not limited to a province, and it dealt with the relationship of trade and commerce, and therefore I felt it had to fall under federal legislator. The questions that I had for fellow students and I thought would be interesting to discuss was, do you agree with the ruling of Manitoba's court and the Supreme Court of Canada? Does the marketing scheme fall under the provincial or federal power? I mean, despite the ruling that's already taking place, I just thought it would be a good discussion. And interesting that Quebec felt the pinch of limiting interprovincial trade through because of the broiler exporting situation, but it was Manitoba who raised the issue, although Manitoba was one of the one of the provinces that didn't retaliate to the broiler restrictions on Quebec. So those were my two discussion questions. And I hope that was within 4 minutes.
Yes, it was. Thank you very much. Well, again, I'll just come over here so I'm close to the recorder, and we can talk about this together. Once again, if you look at your, I don't know if this is in here, it's going to refer to Section 121 of the Constitution Act 1867, and it said that, I'm not sure if it's in the Russell book, it certainly is in the in the Monaghan book. No, they don't have it in Russell. But it says that there shall be free trade of goods between the provinces. Now, when I was an undergraduate student, I worked during the summers at a small lodge in the Rocky Mountains. Forgive me if I told you this last September. But I used to drive the bus between Lake Louise and Lake O'Hara. Let's see if this is Professor Foster. Nope. And one summer for 3 weeks, Bora Laskin who was not Chief Justice then, but on the Supreme Court of Canada, and one of the people that was in the majority in this case. he was a guest there for 3 weeks. His wife really liked hiking, but he didn't. So I drove the bus three times a day between Lake O'Hare and Lake Louise, and he often came with me, with his friend Maura Shumiatru, who's a famous lawyer from Saskatchewan. And they sat right behind me, and they discussed all these kinds of issues. Anyway, I learned from that that Borlaskin was very disappointed that the both the JCPC and the Supreme Court of Canada had not given a broad enough interpretation to Section 121, free trade between the provinces. And he was determined to change that. Now, he had written Canada's main constitutional law text before he was appointed to the Supreme Court of Canada. So that was the main text before the Hogg text. And he was really the first leading academic ever to be appointed by to the Supreme Court of Canada. This was a Trudeau appointee. So his appointment was considered really quite revolutionary. So one of the great things about his part of the decision is that he goes through all of the trade and commerce, the main decisions in trade and commerce since Parsons, and reviews how that initially it was very restrictive, but it seems to be broadening now. And this particular decision was made under trade and commerce. So it's another one of the decisions that broadens the trade and commerce power. So the judges decided the pith and substance of the Manitoba legislation was trade and commerce, interprovincial trade and commerce. So it falls under Section 91.2. But, and it's really quite straightforward that way, but the really interesting thing about this case, it's totally fabricated, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Manitoba did not need to enact legislation to restrict the import of eggs from Quebec, because no eggs were being imported from Quebec. But they wanted to frame legislation that looked as much as possible exactly like the Quebec legislation. And then, as I mentioned last month, all the provinces in their judicature acts have a procedure whereby they can submit any question that they want to their provincial court of appeal. It's almost always a legal question, but they can submit any question they want, and they get an answer. Now, this is part of the court's advisory function. It's not considered an adjudicative function, but the advisory opinions of the courts are always treated like ordinary case law. And then, of course, the provincial court of appeal decision can be appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada. So that's what Manitoba was trying to do. They were certain that this legislation was the Quebec legislation was unconstitutional. So if they can get the question to the Supreme Court of Canada, then this will give them a bargaining tool in terms of being able to negotiate with Quebec and other provinces so that they can market their eggs more freely. Now, before this decision, and up until the 1960s, of course, marketing boards were a fairly new idea in the last century to try to control supply management so that if you can restrict the amount of goods sold, then the price will go up. And I don't know if any of you come from a farming community. I grew up in a farming community in Alberta, and of course, the farmers are always on the edge. You know, if the weather's good, they have a great year, they make some money. But then if the weather's bad, they don't. But it's not, if you want to get rich, it's not a good idea to be a farmer. So the marketing boards were set up to help the farmers so that they could survive. They could earn a decent living from being farmers. But to begin with, the Supreme Court of Canada would rule that provincial marketing boards in some ways controlled interprovincial trade, and so they were unconstitutional. And the federal marketing boards somehow controlled trade within a province, and so they were unconstitutional. So for a while, it looked like no marketing board legislation could be upheld. But according to the exhaustiveness theory, some governments should be able to act. So eventually a solution was found with regard to Prince Edward Island potatoes. What happened is the Prince Edward Island government set up a potato marketing board and appointed members to it. And the federal government set up a potato marketing board and appointed the same members to their board. And the Supreme Court of Canada finally said, okay, since this particular board falls under both federal and provincial jurisdiction, it's constitutional. So then we get to this case where, of course, the interprovincial marketing of eggs is controlled by the province. Obviously, it's unconstitutional. So it gave Laskin a chance to write a very thoughtful opinion, which he was able to set the groundwork for both expanding the interpretation of 91.2, but also, now he doesn't mention section 121. He said it's unnecessary because he can decide under 91.2. Mm-hmm. But it also lays the groundwork for future decisions in which he tried to say, well, look, let's take section 121 seriously, free trade between the provinces, his personal philosophy, as I found out on the bus, was this would be good for the country. We needed to have this interprovincial free trade in order for the country to prosper. But Laskin was very annoyed that the case was contrived. Why was that? Gave him a chance to philosophize and do what he wanted to do. Why was he annoyed that the case was contrived?
Trivializes the matter, trivializes the importance of the matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one reason, yes?
I thought it was because he struggled with not having all the information.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like the empirical data.
Yeah. Judges like to have information on which to base their decisions. What is the impact of this legislation? What does it actually do? Well, there are no eggs coming from Quebec to Manitoba, so he doesn't have that information. So, in some cases, judges will actually say, this case is not justiciable because we don't have any information about how the legislation is in fact operating. So we don't know its impact, we don't know its effect. So after ranting and raving about how horrible this is, nevertheless he decides, because this is a chance for him to comment on section 91.2 and lay the groundwork for expansion of section 121. So, were there any other questions you wanted us to discuss?
No, I'm good.
Well, any questions that you have? So have we answered which came first, the chicken or the egg?
You don't have a lot of care for that.
What's this?
I think the
log came. The log came first, yes. Good. So, well, let's go on to Anand's presentation then. And I think you've got it here on the computer already.
Good evening. My name is Anand. I'm going to talk about the case on Anti-Inflation Act, which was referred to the Supreme Court of Canada. So just to give you a quick background, so this act, called the Anti-Inflation Act, was passed in 1975 by the federal government, actually the Pierre Trudeau's government, and it was enforced until 1978, and it was canceled in 1979. Why did the act come about? It was really under the advice of Bank of Canada, which said that the risk of ongoing inflation at the time was going to be 10% per year. So they requested the federal government to take actions to deal with this. And the response by the federal government was the Anti-Inflation Act, which was meant to be a temporary but an extraordinary measure in an attempt to control high employment and inflation. The key issue here was it wasn't just inflation, there was also high unemployment at the same time, the two factors that were playing together. So the Anti-Inflation Act was a comprehensive program to control the level of income, prices, and profits. So just out of curiosity, I just went to see what was the inflation like back then. Probably doesn't apply to the constitutional law here, but this kind of chart shows you an idea that the inflation was rising. I don't have the unemployment data for the same time. And in 1975, it was getting close to over 12% there. So what was the scope of the act? Well, it wasn't confined to interprovincial and international commerce, so it was going beyond that. And it, activities was regulated that were long regarded as matters of property and civil rights, which as you know, falls in the jurisdiction of the provinces. So, but what the government did is it relied on its general power, and it was hoping that if it goes to court, that national dimension test would be applied, and that national importance made the subject matter a peace order and good governance, under the peace order and good governance. But the government denied, even in parliament, that it wasn't counting on the emergency doctrine. It was really counting on its general power. So the issue is, it's a contentious economic policy. So what the government did, rather than just relying on general power, it negotiated and obtained the support of many of the provinces, except for a couple, to ensure that their provinces didn't come up with court challenges for the law. However, it was attacked by the mainly the Ontario public sector unions, because what happened is the province had, through its opting-in agreement, included the public sector without the enabling legislation passed in the province. So they've kind of included some of the rights of the Ontario public sector into. So this law applied to the public sector as well as the private sector, with certain number of employees and so on. So the question in front of the Supreme Court was whether the act was ultra vires the jurisdiction of Government of Canada. So given there were a lot of issues going on in the lower courts, the government referred this to the Supreme Court of Canada in March 1976 on two questions. The constitutional validity, does it meet the Constitution? And also the validity of the Ontario's opting-in agreement. Is federal government within the constitutional law to enact this act? So the Supreme Court of Canada came up with the said the subject matter of the act is inflation. So which was in it's impossible to assign to one of the enumerated powers because it wasn't listed as an enumerated power for the provinces or the government. But the act was upheld as emergency legislation by a vote of 72. And Justice Beetz, I think my spelling there is wrong. He gave his opinion
that's
on.
Right, that's how you pronounce it, though.
That's how you pronounce it. Thank you. And he gave an opinion on inflation. He said it cannot be brought under the POGG, the Peace Order and Good Government, because it was meant to be applied to narrowly defined subject matters. He felt this was going beyond that scope, and he said it clearly involved matters that fell under the provincial jurisdiction. And there were five out of the nine judges who supported that. And as for the opt-in scheme, they said changes in provincial laws require act of provincial legislator because that should be part of the provincial jurisdiction. So the outcomes and implication, it was victory for some of the provinces, especially like Quebec, British Columbia, who didn't support the act under the national dimension test. They thought it should be part of the emergency doctrine. But it had also had frightening implications for the provinces because an emergency legislation means that you're going now beyond the normal rule of law governing division of power. So the Canadian federalism sort of set aside all powers that are given to the federal government. And it's the first time judiciary invoked the emergency doctrine, and especially as the basis for a peacetime economic regulation. There was no war or anything going on at the time. And the other key thing that came out of this is that the court listened to reports from 39 of the leading economists who said there was no emergency in inflation, at least according to their opinion, and court put very little weight on that. So they kind of let the onus of proof reside with those who challenged the law. So it was kind of interesting. So just to show you what happened in the inflation, they passed the act in 1978, and I'm kind of showing you a picture of inflation going down and going up, not that we don't know the causal relationship. I don't have the unemployment data here. So just to conclusion and further discussion, so the act was deemed ultra vires the jurisdiction of federal government. It was saved by the emergency doctrine, not any of the enumerated powers. And the interesting thing is Parliament did not make a specific statement that there was a state of emergency exists or was decided by the judges. There was, and based on the statute, judges felt that this issue was contemplated for a serious national condition and that was the rationale for basis. So in terms of discussion point, I kind of threw a couple of points. You know, even though government denied it, and it was hoping on national dimension, did they truly know that emergency power could probably save this act? And if they didn't rely explicitly on those powers, was it necessary for the Supreme Court to apply the emergency doctrine to save the law, even though there were no evidence of any emergency at the time? So I'll leave it up for discussion. Thank you.
Those are very good questions.
Thank you.
So, why didn't the federal government argue under the emergency doctrine? Well, I think the arguments of the government lawyers are really developed by the litigation staff. So, in this case, in the Federal Department of Justice, there'd be some very senior lawyers who would have looked at all the precedents that you've studied today. And they'd say, well, gee, in some cases it says that if there's an emergency, that has to be in the legislation. So the Anti-Inflation Act didn't have, this is an emergency, we're encroaching on provincial powers, until the emergency is over, then we'll withdraw. So I think they felt it's going to be really hard to justify this as an emergency. So they thought, well, we can, you know, the national concern branch has been expanding, maybe we can do it here, and of course we have all the provinces on side. Most provinces have dovetailing legislation. And I think the other thing that they were thinking is before anybody gets to court, we'll have inflation under control anyway. So it doesn't really matter if it's struck down. This case was that it got to court a lot more quickly than any government imagined. Because, as you mentioned, the public sector unions in Ontario went to court. And, I mean, it was a very, very intense period. I remember it very well. And there was a threat of wildcat strikes and a lot of civil disobedience. So eventually it went to the Supreme Court as a reference question so that we would get an answer, and this would calm people down. So it got to court much more quickly than people imagined. Now, one of the most interesting aspects of this case, you mentioned that the 39, Lipsy and 39 other economists presented an affidavit saying that the inflation is not an emergency or a crisis, that this is just normal in terms of the business cycle. But the federal government did have some of their own economists that said, yeah, we think this is extraordinary to have high inflation and so much unemployment at the same time. This is unprecedented, and something has to be done. So the court, and this was the very first case in which the Supreme Court of Canada admitted social science evidence. Now, in the United States, you may have heard of the Brandeis brief. That is social science evidence being admitted as evidence in court. And this happened in Oregon in 1908 when Louis Brandeis, the lawyer, was able to get some social science evidence admitted in a social welfare case. He later went on to become a famous judge. But in Canada, this didn't happen until 1976. And the reason it didn't happen is, like before 1908 in the United States, social science evidence is considered, or was considered, hearsay. Because we as social scientists go out and interview people, we generalize from those interviews, but it's not direct testimony. It's based on the research that we do. And up until the 1970s, I must say the judges are much better educated now than they used to be. Some of the judges on the Canadian Supreme Court never went to university. They simply articled in a law firm and then worked their way up through the system and eventually were appointed as a judge. It rose up through the system. So nowadays, judges are all university educated. Many of them have master's degrees, some of them have PhDs. Just about all of them have written books or articles. They love doing their own social science research. So by 1976, times had changed. Social scientists were recognized as judges as maybe having something valuable to contribute. In the interviews that I've done over the years with judges, they like to have useful information. They despise useless information. But useful information is helpful. And so the judges say, well, in this case, yeah, we would like to hear from the economists. If 100% they say there's no crisis, no emergency, that might guide our decision. But since they were split, it doesn't matter how they were split, because it's kind of at random how the experts get to court. But they're split, so it's really a government policy decision as to whether this is serious enough to take action on or not. One of my current research projects is the impact of social science evidence on the Supreme Court of Canada. So I've tried to track down all the cases since 1976 where social science evidence was presented. And it's pretty sparse between 1976 and the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Not every year do you have cases where there's social science evidence. And after the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, it's more frequent, and now it's extremely frequent. There are, I think social science evidence appears in maybe a third of a third to a half of the constitutional cases, and more than that, depending on how you count it. So it's quite important now. And one of the areas of my research is, well, how do social scientists like me present their evidence in court in a way that is understandable and useful to judges? How do we do it ethically? What is the role of the lawyers in this process? So this is this is where it all started in 1976. So the other interesting thing that I find about this case is that Laskin and three other judges invented the crisis doctrine. I think they were thinking, we really can't call this an emergency. There's no epidemic of drunkenness. There's no war. There's no great health issue that is involved here. So we're really going too far to call this an emergency. But surely, peace, order, and good government gives the federal government the right to act in a crisis. And so they went, in this case, to define what a crisis was. So four judges out of nine invented this crisis doctrine. Yes?
Was there a definition of the difference between an emergency and a crisis?
I don't think they differentiated, but they did give a clear definition of what is meant by a crisis, and some examples of it, like high inflation, serious economic issues facing the country. So you can find that in the decision. I can't remember what it was right now. And three judges said, we don't agree with the crisis doctrine. That's too much judicial activism for us. We're going to stick with the precedents. We're going to stick with the emergency doctrine. And even though the legislation does not mention that this is an emergency, everybody knows it is. And so, yes, there's an emergency, and we'll uphold it under that doctrine. Two of the judges said, we don't agree with the crisis doctrine. We agree with the emergency doctrine, but there's no emergency here. If there is an emergency, it would actually have to be in the legislation, and there would have to be a number of other conditions met, so it's not an emergency. So we have three different decisions, seven judges upholding the legislation, for two different sets of reasons. What is the holding in this case? Do we have an emergency doctrine that is part of our constitutional law now or not? Five judges said no, but right. Two were in the minority.
Wasn't unanimous.
Hmm?
Wasn't unanimous.
No. And for the judges in the majority, three of them based their decision on the emergency doctrine, four on the new crisis doctrine. What is the holding? And the answer is, and this is not a trick, I guess it is a trick question. We don't know what the holding is. Except the only thing we know is the legislation was upheld. But we're not sure why it was upheld. And future courts can focus on the traditional emergency doctrine, or they can focus on the crisis doctrine. My reading of Monahan is what he appears to have done is blended the crisis doctrine into the emergency doctrine. He doesn't talk about the crisis doctrine, just the emergency doctrine, but it seems to include now the crisis doctrine. So let's take questions. The other thing I wanted to mention is the point that you mentioned, that the Ontario regulations were not supported by primary legislation. Remember last month I said that secondary legislation can be enacted by a body that is delegated that power by the legislature, but there has to be primary legislation that allows another body like the cabinet to pass regulations, and it has to be clear that the primary legislation has to give that power clearly to another body, and they can take it back at any point. So in this case, the Ontario government was in a minority situation. They couldn't get the agreement of the majority in the legislature to have anti-inflation legislation. So the cabinet merely passed an order in council with the regulations that were needed to go along with the Federal Anti-Inflation Act. But there was no primary legislation. So obviously it was unconstitutional. And that's another part of this, a really important part of this decision.
They retroactively did an enabling legislation after the fact.
Afterwards they did, because there was another election and there was a majority in place, and so they retroactively, and that's, governments can retroactively enact legislation. So my question has always been, why did the Ontario government, knowing that there is no primary legislation that allowed them to make this cabinet order in council, why did they do it? Yes?
I felt by reading the case that there were two reasons. A, that they had already had the provinces in agreement, mm-hmm. Which was in the provinces' interest as well. And second, they just kind of were relying on their own federal power to just get through, mm-hmm. and had everyone else accept what they were saying. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that, the point that I did agree with in the case was that they said that if the province is in agreement with the federal government, then it actually, to take it to a court, then you actually have to rely on a third party to kind of bring up the issue.
So, the answer is, and you're absolutely right, that the provincial cabinet thought they could get away with it, that no one would challenge them. But the unions were smart enough to say, this is not constitutional. There has to be primary legislation in place. And that's where they got into the area of civil disobedience. We don't have to obey provincial regulations that are unconstitutional. So it was a dangerous thing for the cabinet to have done. And it led to the reference question and to this case coming to the Supreme Court very soon after the legislation was passed.
Do you think if the unions had got involved, that it would have been sustained longer? And do you foresee greater consequence that would have come out of that? Like, looking back now, I know hindsight's always 20/20, but...
Well, as your chart showed, after these measures were put into place, inflation did come down.
Come down,
yeah. And part of the reason, it was called the 6 and 5 legislation, so unlike today, where you have a freeze on public sector wages, in those days it was considered if you had a 6% rise, you couldn't raise wages more than 6%. They had been going up 12%. So 6% was considered a freeze for some parts, and 5% for other parts.
I take that.
So 6 to 5. But if inflation is 12% and you're restricted to 6% increase in your wages, then your wages are actually less. Buy less. So that's why people were so angry. I'm not an economist. I've studied economics, because you have to study economics to understand public administration. But it's sort of like studying theology. You need to understand it, but it's a bit mysterious how it all happens. So I guess my own opinion is that these measures whether they had a direct impact or it was just a psychological impact, it did bring down inflation, temporarily at least. So it was probably a good thing that it happened. I mean, if you countries where they have galloping inflation, it destroys the country. But now we're in a totally different era.
Yeah, it's a totally different era.
Most people have forgotten what inflation is all about. Very strange. Those are good questions. Any other questions or comments on this case? Yes?
Question about how the evidence goes before the Supreme Court about social science. Are they qualified as experts? Is that how they get?
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. So I've been an expert, a social science expert, in four cases. One of the cases went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. So the cases normally have to start in the lower court. This is exceptional because it's a reference case. It goes straight to the Supreme Court. And so the rules are a bit different. But normally, the case would start either in the Ontario Court of Justice or the provincial level court, or more likely the Superior Court of Ontario, or the Supreme Court of Ontario. And the lawyers for both sides would have to apply to the court for permission to introduce expert evidence. So in Ontario, the way that this is done is the expert writes what they call a report. And the other side has a right to cross-examine the expert who issues the report. So the report is submitted as an official court document. The other side gets it. They have a certain amount of time to decide if they want to cross-examine. In Ontario, the cross-examination is done in another lawyer's office. And everything is transcribed and then goes to the judge. I was an expert in a case in Alberta where the expert testimony is actually done in court. So in Alberta, it's called an affidavit. So I submitted an affidavit to the court, and then I was examined in chief by my lawyer, but then for 2 days cross-examined by the lawyer for the other side. I think I've got time to tell you a little bit about that case if you're interested.
Yes.
It was the L case. Went to the Supreme Court in 2002. The case started in 1997 in Alberta. Now, this has a lot to do with the administration of justice. Many justices of the peace across Canada are not lawyers. That doesn't mean they're bad at what they do. But in Alberta, what happened is the jurisdiction of the JP courts was increased significantly. And the jurisdiction was taken away from the provincial court and given to the JP courts. The Alberta government said that, in order to decide what qualifications the sitting JP should have, we'll let the Alberta Judicial Council decide that. The Judicial Council is composed of Chief Justices, Associate Chief Justices in Alberta, and members of the Law Society and the Bar Association. And they said, because of the level of jurisdictions increased so much, these people should all be lawyers with at least 5 years' experience. So that was a decision not by the government, but by the Judicial Council. None of the sitting JPs, I think, had university education, so they didn't have much beyond a high school education. But they had been hearing lower-level cases, like parking tickets, for quite a few years. Now they were hearing cases, minor cases, under the criminal code. So they were not fired, but they were given other JP duties other than hearing cases. They went to court saying that's a violation of judicial independence. And so I was hired as an expert to argue that that was not a violation of judicial independence. And that was something I studied when I was doing my dissertation research on the causes of unnecessary delay in Ontario courts years before. So, anyway, it was interesting because one of my co-authors for a number of publications, Peter McCormick, was hired as the expert for the JP side. So, always an expert, the first thing they do is they try to destroy your credibility. So they look at everything that you've written to try to find something that contradicts your affidavit. I was saying, I've written what I always believed in. So, and Peter read everything. So. They didn't try that for very long. And there was no sense me giving evidence to my lawyer to destroy his credibility, since he's a year older than me. Got me my first teaching job. So, but anyway, it was a very interesting exchange. And we lost, our side lost a trial. We lost on appeal, and we won 9-0 at the Supreme Court of Canada. But the lawyer that I worked for in Alberta he was really good. He said, look, write for the Supreme Court. You've studied the Supreme Court, you've read many of their decisions. Write something that they will understand and that they will find convincing. Forget about the trial, forget about the appeal. This is going all the way to the Supreme Court. So I was cross-examined in Calgary, now just to show you how important the cross-examination is, this occurred just before the big snowstorm that we had in 1997. Remember that? Where the Mel Lastman called in the army?
Yes.
Anyway, I phoned Alberta and I said, look, we're getting this big snowstorm. I can't come. He said, get on the plane. You are coming. That's how important it was for me, because if I didn't come, we'd lose all credibility. Even with a snowstorm. So I got the last plane out of Toronto. My wife phoned me in Calgary and said, I think our roof is going to collapse. the cross-examination went on all day Friday. I flew out Thursday night. So I had to fly back to Toronto to clean the snow off the roof Friday night, and at the expense of Alberta taxpayers, fly back again Sunday night in order to continue the cross-examination Monday. So, once again, that's how important the cross-examination is. No excuses for not showing up. Anyway, it was a fascinating experience. Any more questions about the anti-inflation case? Peter Russell wrote an interesting article about this shortly after the decision, saying it was the right decision because of the seriousness of inflation, but for the wrong reasons. I think he would have gone on to national concern. Okay, well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And then. So, another really fascinating case, Ron Corelli versus Duplessis. So, Ron Corelli was a Jehovah's Witness in Quebec. He ran a restaurant in the Queen Elizabeth Hotel in downtown Montreal. So all of you who've been to Montreal know where the Queen Elizabeth Hotel is. So he was doing very well financially running this restaurant. Now, a number of Jehovah's Witnesses during this era had been charged with distributing literature without a permit. Jehovah's Witnesses literature can be quite insulting to the Roman Catholic Church and to Roman Catholics. And so when the JW started distributing their literature in Quebec, there was a lot of pressure on municipal and the Quebec government to stop them from doing it. The city of Montreal had a bylaw that prohibited anyone from distributing literature without a permit in order to keep the streets clean and so on. And so everybody that wanted to distribute literature got a permit except the JWs. They never got it. So there were some very interesting cases that went to court that eventually struck down these bylaws as being a violation of the division of powers. So this was during an era when the courts in Canada were protecting human rights through the division of powers, because we didn't have a Bill of Rights, we didn't have a Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and as I mentioned in September's class, Dicey wrote that if judges correctly applied the rule of law, you didn't need a written Bill of Rights. The rule of law, correct interpretation, would protect human rights. So we did see some examples of this in the 1950s. Anyway, every time a Jehovah's Witness was charged with distributing literature without a permit, they would have otherwise gone to jail, but Ron Corelli posted bail for them so that they'd stay out of jail until their case got to court, and of course it would be thrown out. Maurice Duplessis was the Union Nationale Premier of Quebec in the 40s and 50s. He plays a pivotal role in Canadian history because he really operated the province like a dictatorship. He didn't really understand the concept of human rights. One of the human rights lawyers in Quebec around that time was Pierre Trudeau. Pierre Trudeau wrote in a magazine called Cité Libre, advocating human rights, very critical of the Duplessis government for its violations of human rights. And so Duplessis got in touch with all the universities in Quebec and said, never hire Trudeau to teach on your staff. So Trudeau never got a teaching job. And that's one of the reasons he was so much in favor of a Charter of Rights and Freedoms. He did not believe that Dicey was correct, that the correct application of the rule of law by judges is all we needed to protect human rights. Wasn't working in Quebec. So, Premier Duplessis himself canceled Ron Corelli's liquor license at his restaurant in the Queen Elizabeth Hotel. Now, if you go to Montreal and you want to have a nice meal, would you go to a restaurant that doesn't have a liquor license? If you're a Quebecer, no. You have to have a liquor license if you're going to stay in business. So basically, this was his way of putting Ron Corelli out of business. So Frank Scott, quite a famous Canadian lawyer and famous Canadian poet, he's actually quite a good poet, represented Ron Corelli and went to court and argued that Duplessis had abused his power. According to the Dicean definition, he had made Ron Corelli suffer for something other than a violation of the law. The argument was that there was no law that gave Duplessis the power to cancel Ron Corelli's liquor license, and therefore he was acting arbitrarily. And the argument went on to say that even the cabinet minister who was in charge of the regulations didn't have the power to cancel Ron Corelli's license, because the law had to be applied evenly and equally to everyone and fairly. And to cancel, single out one person to cancel their license, because I think the argument of the Quebec government was that Ron Corelli was an evil influence on Quebec society, and therefore they had the right to cancel his license. And the Supreme Court said, no, the law has to be applied equally to everyone, and you cannot make arbitrary exceptions, as in this case. So Duplessis couldn't cancel the license. The minister in charge in the cabinet couldn't do it either. So what happened after this is the Quebec government revised its liquor legislation to give it, potentially give it the power to cancel Ron Corelli's license anyway. Now, that legislation was later overturned, because this was 1959. 1960 was the beginning of the Quiet Revolution in Quebec. And this is where the Duplessis government was defeated by the Lesage Liberals. And much of the draconian legislation that was enacted by the Duplessis government was repealed and replaced. And it led to, amongst other things, the independentist movement in Quebec. It led to the Quebec Francophones in Quebec becoming very interested in the business community, and some of the richest business people in Canada now are Francophones from Quebec. So there's a huge revolution in education, religion, everything changed beginning in 1960 in Quebec. So this is the very end of the period before the Quiet Revolution. And so Ron Corelli won. his case, and this is held up as a shining example of the of how the application of the rule of law by judges can protect human rights. Problem is that Ron Corelli had long before gone bankrupt because he didn't have a liquor license. And I think he died in poverty, but still celebrated by Jehovah's Witnesses up till this day. It is a sad story.
Gosh, I'm gonna cry now.
But this, without thinking about what happened to Ron Corelli, how he suffered for this case, the important thing to keep in mind is that elected politicians, there are legal remedies to abuse of power. The trick is getting them to court in time to do some good. Poor old Homer Cotter won two very important cases in the Supreme Court of Canada, 2008, 2010. And then there's other litigation pending that he would have won, but he still remained much too long in Guantanamo Bay. So that's another sad story. Any questions about Ron Corelli versus Du Plessis? Yes?
It's probably a little unrelated, but Du Plessis, is there a way to, like, and in other countries you have, you can go to court for these things, for, for violating the law and knowing that? Is there anything existing like that in Canada where you can try the actual politician? Or is that not something that we have?
Would that be tort? Probably tort. Would that be maybe go after him civilly, though?
That's a really good question.
Because it's an abuse of, obviously an abuse of power, but like directed at somebody who's completely innocent.
Wouldn't the remedy be in the civil courts?
Well, back in those days, there were limitations on suing the government. So those limitations have gradually eroded over the years. So nowadays, you can sue the government just like you can sue another person, although you have to launch your suit a little bit sooner than you would for an ordinary person. But, it is possible to sue the government.
Not the government body.
Or individual people.
Like the actual politician.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is possible to do that.
Okay.
I'm just trying to think of, I think her first name is Helena Georges.
Yes.
The former MP. Pardon?
My old MP.
Your old MP. Is it Helena?
MP. That's right. Yeah. She was a PCer.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, she was fired by Harper and sued him and the Conservative Party and lost. So it's, yes, you can sue, but the evidence has to be very, very, very clear that there was an abusive process and that you suffered as a result. So, and it's expensive. So, yes?
Good question. As you mentioned, that accessing the justice is as expensive as it is, but do you think it is due to limiting the access to justice, or is it just the system so that only few people who are very, very interested in actually challenging the writ of the government?
There are two ways of answering that question. Some people would say, I told you about how courts were established beginning in 1066 in England. We've inherited that system. Over time, it becomes more and more and more complex. And then action has to be taken to reduce the complexity and make justice more accessible. And that's just a process that goes on forever. There's no plot against poor people. The other answer that would be given to you by Michael Mandel is that the status quo is to benefit the wealthy, and so they like to maintain it and not change it because they benefit from it. So I'd like to study the actual system and find resolutions to problems so I don't take part in that theoretical debate. Any other questions? Yes?
There's one Corelli JW.
Yes.
And the second is, would the literature that he was distributing at that time be considered offending literature in the Charter era?
That is a really good question. You folks are full of good questions. In other words, next month we'll be talking about one of the hate speech cases. The Keekster case, that's right. So there is a law in Canada that it's a criminal offense to promote hatred against an identifiable group. There are lots of restrictions. No one should be prosecuted without the permission of the provincial attorney general, for example. So it's very rare to use because it gets people more publicity than they deserve. would the literature that they're distributing be considered hate speech? I've seen some of the literature that was being distributed in the 1950s, and it is pretty offensive. But I don't think it would be considered as promoting hatred against an identifiable group. I'm not sure to what extent the literature has changed, but it was very, very critical of the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic Church was referred to as the Great Whore. But they didn't advocate that JW should be violent against Roman Catholics. Just advocated that they should become JWs instead of Roman Catholics. Yes?
I was just wondering, besides the distribution of the literature itself, is there a qualification that you have to be a person of influence or something in order for it to be considered hate speech? What is the...
No.
No?
No. Promoting hate, you have to be... there has to be lots of evidence that you were promoting hatred against an identifiable group. And if this is likely to lead to violence.
Okay.
Whether or not you intended to lead to violence, it's likely to lead to violence.
Okay.
That's why Jones didn't get into Canada last week.
Yeah.
Even though he said, well, I don't want to cause violence.
Yeah.
Even the human rights lawyers are saying, well, of course, if he says what he's going to say, it'll end in violence.
Yeah.
And so whether he believes it or not, it doesn't matter. It violates the law in Canada.
Mm-hmm. And the U.S. is a lot more.
Oh, the U.S., they let anything happen and then they take action after.
Yeah.
We'll be talking about this more next month, but there's a lot of controversy as to whether we need a hate speech law. One of my former PhD students, who's Jewish, wrote a wonderful dissertation on a book that the law does more harm than good. And that even people like Keekster and Zundo should be tolerated. Yes?
I had a question about the Supreme Court and their caseload. So they have quite a lot of discretion as to what case they choose to bring into the court. With something like this, which kind of seems to be just Quebec, would it be, like today, if it was happening today, would it be brought to the Supreme Court?
That's not another good question.
Okay.
So the Supreme Court controls its own caseload, except for a few as of right appeals that deal with serious criminal matters where the courts fully disagree. But 60 of the 100 cases that go to the Supreme Court every year, the court itself decides we're going to hear these cases through panels of three. And they will only take a case if they think it's of national legal importance. It doesn't matter whether they think the lower court is right or wrong. But it has to be an issue of national legal importance. And different judges think of that differently. So for a case like this, in those days there was no restriction on the right of appeal. So Ron Curley had a right to go to the Supreme Court of Canada. But nowadays, I think an issue like this, yeah, it would be of national legal importance. And it would get to court. Yes?
When we say that Supreme Court issues right to appeal,
mm-hmm.
Does it have to be presented in case of a submission, or does it have to be presented in front of the judge?
leave to appeal?
Application.
Oh, yeah, the application for leave to appeal or permission to appeal. It's a written application. I think it's restricted to about 40 pages. And it's submitted by a lawyer to the Supreme Court of Canada. The Chief Justice divides the courts into panels of three, and those panels are shifted around all the time, so the membership is different. Not all the time, but I think on a monthly or bi-monthly basis. And the panels look at the application and they make a decision. Is this of national legal importance? If so, we recommend that the court hears. Their recommendations then go to the full court, not in a meeting with the full court, but by memo to all the other judges. And if any of the other judges disagree with the recommendation, then it's discussed in a meeting with the full court. And they decide yea or nay. And it's interesting, the judges on the Supreme Court, I interviewed eight of them, and they said about 20% of the time we grant leave to appeal when we shouldn't. They fooled us. They said there's an issue here of national legal importance, it seemed compelling, but really they were just trying to get the Supreme Court to delay. And once they made their arguments here, there was no substance to their arguments. But 80% of the time they say they're right. Any other questions?
Just the makeup of the three judges that are chosen. How are they determined?
By the Chief Justice.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and they're rotated almost mathematically.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in order so that the personalities won't affect the outcome.
Yeah.
They may try to make sure that there's at least one woman in every panel, for example. But it's not. The panels aren't struck according to expertise.
Okay.
Any other questions? Good. Before I talk about Monahan Chapter 8, if anyone would like to refill their cups or get a cookie or some of that fruit before it goes bad, you're welcome to do it.